If you are visiting with us this evening, you are kind of in the middle of something. And what we're doing as a congregation is answering questions for ourselves as to why we do what we do, why we don't do what we don't do, and basically understanding, getting underneath the hood of how a local congregation operates in a biblical fashion. There's a lot of different ways that churches could work and function. And we obviously are only one route. And as you look, even in the city of Monroe, there's probably 30 to 40 different churches in the city limits. And that only happens because there's disagreement about what route to take. If we all were in agreement, you wouldn't have those sorts of differences. You'd probably have one, maybe two churches due to the size of the congregations if everybody agreed. But there is a reason for it. So what we're doing is we're kind of getting underneath the hood, looking at, there it is, looking at why we do what we do. And so what we're dealing with are some deeper doctrinal questions. And one of those is, how does a church choose what good works to do? I have a list here that I've shown probably 3-4 weeks at this point of a variety of good works. And everybody agrees that they are good works. But they're also good works that we as a congregation don't do. And we've talked about a lot of reasons why. But one thing that we haven't really covered is that these are good works, and we're not saying a Christian can't do these things. We're not saying a Christian can't give blood or give money to give make sure that third world countries have clean drinking water. We're not saying a Christian as an individual cannot feed the homeless, or a Christian as an individual can't raise school supplies for children in their community. In fact, I'm convinced we should be doing lots of those things as individuals. And this is where the confusion comes in, is as I read through my Bible, I see quite often the need for good works for Christians to do that these would fit into the category of. And yet we're saying as a church, we can't. And what we mean by that is there is a difference between an individual Christian and a local church. And we're going to talk about that difference tonight. Because the confusion over that difference has led to lots and lots of problems in churches. Where people say, well, yeah, it's a good work. But what they're actually referring to is something that's good for us as individuals to do, but not something that the church as a whole has been called to. We've talked about what the work of the church is, and we'll probably talk some more about it. But we need to understand that there is a distinct line God draws between what a Christian as an individual can and should be doing and what a church can and should be doing. And we're going to do it the easy way. I believe in doing things the easy way as much as possible because that's the way that works for me. We're going to look at one verse. And I'm going to prove it to you in one verse. Now, before anybody comes up to me later, yes, I'm going to reference some other verses. But they're all going to be connected to one verse. In one verse, I can prove to you how big of a deal it is that churches not confuse themselves with individuals. That it is not just something that, yes, the Bible teaches there's a difference, but that God commands clearly we need to respect that difference and not have individuals do what the church is to do, and more importantly, not have the church do what the individual is supposed to do. That one verse is 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16. Now, to give you the context to it, 1 Timothy chapter 5 begins in verse 2 and 3 with saying, honor widows who are widows indeed, or honor widows who are really widows. That is, they are really alone. And in 1 Timothy chapter 5, he begins to list circumstances in which a church, a congregation, would have the responsibility to take care of a widow in the church, a Christian widow, who had nobody else to watch over her. That the church has a right and a responsibility if there is an older woman who has not got a husband to take care of her. And it begins to list a variety of qualifications for this widow, in the same way that there are qualifications for elders, in the same way that there are qualifications for deacons, in the same way that there are qualifications for preachers. There are qualifications for the type of widow the church has a right to take care of. And it mentions that one of the things it mentions is that she is to be a woman of 60 years old or older. Verse 10 mentions she's to have a good reputation for good works. She's been known for showing hospitality to strangers. She's assisted those who are distressed. She doesn't have any children or grandchildren who could take care of her beside the church. And then you get down, all the way down to verse 16, and it sums the whole thing up after listing all these qualifications. And it says, if any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened, so it may care for those who are really widows. So verse 3 says, honor widows who are really widows. And then verse 16 ends up by saying, well, if she's not over 60 years old, she's not really a widow. She doesn't meet the qualifications here. If she has children that can take care of her, or grandchildren that can take care of her, let them do it. She doesn't meet the qualifications. Or if there is somebody else in the church as an individual who has been taking care of her and she's a dependent of them, well, let her take care of her so that the church will not be burdened, so that it can care for those who are really widows. This passage, this one verse here, covers three distinct important concepts that we have to understand regarding the difference between the church and individual. Number one, it says simply there is a difference between an individual Christian and a congregation. You notice in the verse, if there's a believing woman and she has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened. So who is it? The individual believing woman is to be burdened, and the church is not to be burdened. You know what's interesting about this is that here is a distinction between the individual and the church, and most likely the woman here, the believing woman who's taking care of these widows, is a member of that church. And yet he says there's a distinction. That is, there is a distinction between Roger Swenson over there as an individual Christian and the things he does, and then Roger Swenson as a part of the local work here. There's a distinction between Steve Wilkes as an individual and the things that he does, and then Steve Wilkes as a part of this local work here. That distinction is made very clear in that verse. There's the believing woman, and if she takes care of the widow, who's not taking care of the widow? The church isn't. And we understand and appreciate this difference in other verses as well. That an individual is not representative of the church, and the church is not representative of the individual. They're not the same. Did Simon the Magician represent all the church in Samaria? If you go back to Acts 8 and you read about Simon the Magician, and he became jealous and bitter-hearted, and he went to Peter and he tried to buy with money the gifts of the Holy Spirit. And Peter rebuked him and said, "You repent." Does that mean everybody in the church in Samaria had the same bitter heart? No, that was one man. Now, was he part of the church in Samaria? Absolutely. But he didn't represent the whole church. He was his own man. Or in Revelation chapter 3, verse 1 through 5, it talks about the church in Sardis. And the church in Sardis receives a reprehensible grade by Jesus Christ. He sends messengers to these seven churches in Asia. And Sardis, its messenger is told, tell them, you're dying. You're a mess. I'm going to remove your lampstand. You're displeasing to me. But then he mentions, but there are some amongst you that are still clothed in white, still clinging to the truth, still pure in my eyes. There's a distinction made. And I give thanks for that. Because that means that you as an individual will stand before God and you're not accountable for everything that the local church here does. And the local church is not accountable for what every individual does. Won't that be nice? Wouldn't it be a horrible thing? You get to the judgment day and say, well, by the way, did you know it? You at the congregation you attended there in Monroe Valley, there were people who did this and this and this and this. And then all of a sudden you and I were held accountable on the day of judgment for what other members did. There's a distinction, and God makes that distinction. A congregation as a whole can be receiving a pretty poor marks, but an individual can be receiving a good grade. The opposite is also true. You can have a congregation that's receiving quite a lot of praise from God, but then individual Christians within that congregation who are not. Well, what about Paul in Acts chapter 9? Acts 9, 26 to 27 points of a rather odd little circumstance, which is Paul, who has been converted, is most definitely a Christian and is most definitely pleasing to God, is rejected by the church in Jerusalem because they only know of Paul, the persecutor of Christians who tries to kill him. And they said, we don't have... He tried to join himself to the church, and the church said, no, we don't. We won't be joined to you. It took Barnabas coming in to help mend those fences and make things right. When Paul was rejected by the church in Jerusalem, did that mean he was rejected by God? Paul, for a time there, was a man without a congregation. Not by his design, but he was still a man who was a part of the universal body of Christians. So there's a difference between an individual Christian and a congregation. Now, the second thing that this passage teaches you is that the church can't do everything an individual can. As you go through 1 Timothy 5 and it lists all of these different things, one of them is the church cannot care for a widow who is under 60 years old. So that means that the church cannot financially support long-term a 59-year-old widow. That's what the Bible says. Now, that may make us squeamish sometimes to go, boy, that just, I don't like that. But that's what it says. You go 1 Timothy chapter 5, and it says quite simply in verse 9, a widow is to be put on the list only if she's not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man. The church can only put 60-year-old and older widows on the roll to take care of long-term financially. But how about you? If you knew a 59-year-old widow, do you think you might maybe consider helping her out a little bit? You better. You ought to. Let us do good unto all men, and especially the household of faith. That's the command of the individual. And yet the church is told it should not be burdened. The church, unless she meets these qualifications, the church can't do it. It is not allowed. It is commanded no, 100%. So that means there are things that an individual can do and should do and must do that the church absolutely cannot do under any circumstances. There's a difference. And we have to recognize and appreciate that difference. Because as we talk about the work of the church, it's not the same as the work that you can do as an individual. The opportunities and to do good unto all men, especially the household of faith, that you have as an individual are vast and plentiful. The church's work is much, much narrower as a collective congregation. Let me give you some examples of how true this is. In Acts chapter 3, down in verse 6, Peter has gone up to the temple, and he's going to go up through the beautiful gate. And he's going to go through the beautiful gate, and there's a man sitting there who is a lame man. Not a Christian, has not converted to Christ at all, not a believer, but he is very much a truly needy man. He has people bring him to the gate every day, has for years and years and years. And so Peter speaks to the man, and the man looks up at him expecting some money, and Peter says, I have no silver and gold to give to you. Now here's what I want to show you. Peter either is saying he as an individual doesn't have that money, or he's lying. Because In Acts 3 there, he says, I have no silver and gold. But we find out in Acts chapter 4 that all this time that Peter's been out preaching and teaching, he would come back to be with the brethren. And you know what was happening? In Acts chapter 4, verse 32, it says, the multitude of those who believed were one heart and one soul, and neither did anyone say that any of the things he possessed was his own, but they had all things in common. Verse 34, nor was there anyone among them, that is among the church there in Jerusalem, who lacked. For all who were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of the things that were sold, and they laid them at the apostles' feet. And they, that is the apostles, distributed to each one as anyone had need. We find out in Acts chapter 4 that the same Peter who went to the temple and told the lame man, I have no silver and gold, how much silver and gold had been given to him? Buckets of stuff. People had been selling land. We're talking thousands and thousands of dollars laid at the apostles' feet. And that was given to them as the apostles to distribute as any had need. They had the authority to distribute. So why did Peter say, I don't have any silver or gold? Let me show you why. Because Peter had the same problem Rod has. Best part of the sermon, Rod's taking notes, doesn't see the picture of himself come up. I get to watch his face as the picture comes up. These are these wonderful little moments I cherish in my heart. We have a treasurer. Rod is the treasurer for the congregation here in Monroe. So in 1 Corinthians 16, it talks about the church, and when it takes up a collection, do so on the first day of the week. And so at store up. And so as we store up, we have a treasurer who watches the money that is stored up. And so Rod is a man with two checkbooks. And I want you to know, Rod is living a double life. Rod has two checkbooks. And he has a beautiful wife who is cold all winter long. All winter long, all you will hear from Denise is cold. Brr. She doesn't warm up till it's about 107, right? The surface of the sun is about the right temperature for her. Now, Rod has in one pocket a checkbook with the church's money. He has full, unfettered access to it. And he has this wonderful bride who would just like to go to Hawaii. He got lots of money in that pocket. Now, over in the other pocket, he's broke. He's got his own checkbook. And that checkbook's been spent entirely on tractors. So he has no money. But in this checkbook, in this pocket, he's got all of the church's money. Now, let me ask you, do you see any difference between those two checkbooks? Can Rod use the church's checkbook in place of his own? Can he say, you know, I really, really want Denise to go to Hawaii. Some warm sand between her toes, the sun, some heat, some tropical air, that would do her good. Can he take that checkbook? Would you be okay with that? Absolutely not. And Rod's not okay with it. In fact, Rod's so not okay with it, I don't care how small the dollar figure, he's never going to switch the two checkbooks. He says, what about 10 cents? Could he write a 10-cent check from this pocket, from the church's treasury, to do something for himself? If you ask Rod, he's going to say no. And that's because he's a man of integrity. Now remember Peter who said, silver and gold I do not have? And that's the same as if Denise comes up to Rod and says, Rod, I just want to go to Hawaii. And he says, I'm so sorry, honey. I have many a tractor, but money for Hawaii I do not have. Is he lying when he has the church's checkbook in his other pocket? No, he's telling the truth. He doesn't have it. It's not his money. When Peter had all that money from the houses that had been sold, the land that had been sold, all these things, it was laid at his feet to be distributed. It was to be distributed as a leader in the church, and the church does not have the right to give money to a lame man who sits at the temple gate. So Peter wasn't lying when he said, I don't have silver or gold. Can Ron take the church's money and put it in his bank account? Now, if you ask whether he physically can, the answer is yes. It would not be hard, would it? It would be real easy. But he can't, because of integrity. See, we don't think of that as a small thing when you think of it in that kind of regard. It's a major issue of integrity. Why? Because there's a difference between the individual and the church. And Peter recognized that difference. In 1 Corinthians 16, when the church is told how to collect money, it says, concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given orders to the churches of Galatia, so you must do also. On the first day of the week, let each one of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there be no collections when I come. And when I come, whomever you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem. That is, you collect it up, and once the individual has laid it aside and stored it up in the church's treasury and collection, then it's your gift. It's the church, in this case, the church in Corinth's gift. And it's no longer any individual's money. It belongs to that particular work. So there is a huge difference between an individual and church, and there are many things that the church simply can't do, and an individual can. Now there's one more thing, a third thing. If we ignore this, and if a congregation does an individual's work for it, it burdens the congregation and it robs the individual of opportunity to grow. Because if you look in that verse, 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16, the individual is to take care of the widow who's not really a widow indeed, so that the church will not be burdened. That is, the church has things it has to do, and if I begin to throw all of my own personal doings, my own personal work on top of it, it won't have the energy to do its work. So if we don't pay attention to the difference between the individual and the church becomes burdened, and I want you to also see that the individual becomes robbed. So let's talk about the burdening of the church first, and then we'll go back to the what it does to the individual, because both parties get hurt by this. And you see it every day in churches, where a congregation, once it stops paying attention to this authority, it becomes caught up in all sorts of things and loses its mission and purpose. And you find individuals who miss out on opportunities to be who they ought to be. That word, be burdened, this is the Greek definition of it. Just so you know, if you look up Greek, this is the sort of thing that I stare at all day. And if you're bored by this, sorry. But this is the Greek word for burden, bario. And there's multiple definitions, and I want you to see it's translated different ways, depending on the context. But it's the same word. When it talks about the church not being burdened, it sometimes means that means it shouldn't be distressed financially. That is, if the church begins to take care of widows who aren't really widows, there becomes a financial distress there. Because the church has a finite amount of money. And if it's spending money over here, guess what that means? Doesn't have money spent over here. There's a financial distress. It also means to be fast asleep, to be burdened with sleep. It becomes lethargic. If you look at the work of the church, things that we have discussed and will discuss more, but in short, the work of the church can be found to be really three things: to teach the saved, to preach to the lost, and when necessary, to care for needy Christians. That's the work. And it is a small, focused, sniper scope set of work. It's very nimble. It's meant to be doing just that and do it very, very well. The moment you begin to pile other things on it, all of a sudden it's kind of like after Thanksgiving. How do you feel when you filled your gut with too much food? lethargic. You're no longer focused. You become weighed down. It's even used to be grieved. An idea of it becomes a sorrowful circumstance. What Paul is telling Timothy is, make sure the church is doing the stuff the church ought to do, because if it begins to do stuff it wasn't meant to do, it will not be good at any of it. It'll instead become an organization that doesn't do what God intended it to do. It will not be strong in that area. It will be burdened down. It will become lethargic. It will not be focused on getting people to heaven, which is what the church is all about. But then there's a second aspect to that. If the church is burdened, if I take what I'm supposed to be doing and I give it to the church, now all of a sudden it's not my job. And that sounds great up front, doesn't it? I like the idea of giving somebody else the work. I love it. As my kids are getting older and I can give them chores that I don't want to do. Vaughn is now beginning to mow the lawn. It is fantabulous. But when we are not doing work God tells us to do, we miss out on the benefit that the work gives to us. Skip back a little earlier in 1 Timothy chapter 5, and it talks about the individuals who are supposed to take care of the widows who aren't really widows indeed. It says, if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God. You notice there, if the individual takes care of the work that they've been given to do, what do? They learn. They grow. And we all know this to be true. When we go out and we push our comfort zones and we do the things that God tells us to do, 6 months later, a year later, what do you find? You are a better, stronger, more faithful person because you did that which God intended. You learn something from it. You grow. We're told to store up treasures for ourselves in heaven. If I'm always having the church do my work, I'm not storing those treasures up. I don't get credit for it. I don't get growth from it. I'm not learning and applying. We're told that maturity comes from those who have exercised themselves. If I don't exercise myself in the work that God intends me to do as an individual, I don't learn. I don't grow. And so it sounds great in the beginning of, I'll just write a check and have the church do it instead, but what happens is I never grow up. I never become the kind of Christian I ought to be. I come, I sit in the pew, write my check, somebody else does the work, I feel good about myself, but I'm never mature. I never have learned to fully give my life to Christ. I treat Christianity as a service. And in 1 Timothy 5, verse 3 and 4, it says the thing that you learn is to show piety. That word piety is not a word you use every day. That's kind of a religious word. But it also has a meaning, and it's translated two words. Half of the time it's translated piety, and half of the time it's translated worship. It means devotion. And in the context, the devotion is to God. How do I learn to become individually, as an individual person, as me who will stand before God on the judgment day without the Church of Monroe there? It will be me before my Maker. How do I learn to devote myself to Him? I do the work that's been given to me, and I don't try and have somebody else do it. That's the only way. That's the only way you can learn to be devoted to God, is to go through the things God intends for you to go through. You see, really, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 17 says it. If you call on the Father who without partiality judges according to each one's work. Whose work? It's not the work of the church. Who's God going to judge impartially? Your own individual work. If you call on the Father who without partiality judges according to the individual's work, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your stay here, that is your life, in fear. The most important work will always be the individual's. The church should not rob him of it, but prepare him for it. What you see over and over and over again is that the relationship between a local congregation and each individual Christian is one of teaching and preparation. One where it makes the individual stronger so that individuals can supply their own labor to God's work. It's not supposed to stand in for us. It's not supposed to do the job for us. It's supposed to equip us to do the job ourselves so that we will be able to stand before God on the day of judgment and say, this is what I did. And I stood on the shoulders of those who helped teach me. I stood on the shoulders of those who encouraged me and exhorted me, as we are told the assembling does of the congregation does. It is an encouragement and an exhortation and it's teaching. But we each do the work we're supposed to do. What I want you to see is that the separation between the individual and the church, a lot of times we get so focused on it's what the church can't do. And that's how somewhere down the road we got branded as antis. They're just opposed to everything. Let me tell you what I'm anti. I'm anti the church taking away your treasure in heaven. I'm anti us being a bunch of slugs who don't know how to devote ourselves and haven't learned to have that kind of close and strong and faithful relationship with God individually because we just had somebody else, namely the church in Monroe, do the work for us. What we're opposed to is not getting the work done. We're opposed to doing it the wrong way that robs the individual of the opportunity to grow. Robs you of the opportunity to store up treasures for yourself in heaven, eternal treasures. That's what I'm opposed to. That's what this congregation is opposed to. And that's why we keep the scope. The eldership is very clear on this is the work that the Bible has given for us to do, and we don't go beyond that because our job is to equip you to be the best you can be so that you, as individuals, each of us as individuals, will be people of devotion to God who have learned and done the good works, done good unto all men, especially the household of faith. The invitation song is number 661.